Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Royals, Rebels, and Romantics. I am delighted to welcome Miranda Malins, who's joining us for a really interesting discussion about someone I'm afraid gets overlooked a bit. So, Miranda, welcome, and thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me, Caroline.
I'm going to start with a question that just sort of asks about how you enter this period of time. So, when we think about the history of England, the history of Britain, and we often think about a narrative including kings and queens, but there's a gap that's often sort of overlooked. We just sort of jump over it. So, what drew you to focus on the gap in the royal history?
Well, you're so right. It is a gap. And in fact, I think I was first interested in it, you know, almost as a child at school. I mean, I have the famous wooden kings and queens ruler here.
Ruler of rulers, yeah.
Ruler of rulers, which your listeners and watchers may be familiar with, where we have the wonderful neat story. We have William, Henry, Stephen, Henry, Richard, John, and so on and so on and so on. Infinite Edwards and Henrys, etc. But it always intrigues me. What is this little gap here where it just says Commonwealth? Sometimes it says Commonwealth. Sometimes it says Cromwell or Cromwell's. Sometimes it just skips right over it.
Right.
And you just have Charles I, goes straight to Charles II. And we're so proud in Britain, rightly, I might add, of our long and durable and stable monarchy. And there's much to celebrate in that. But I think because it's lasted so long, you know, it's lasted these 1,000 years and it's still going today, you know, we're a bit embarrassed about this weird little glitch in the middle of it that we like to skip over. And I guess that appealed to me. I liked the idea of the anomaly in the story and wanted to find out more.
Well, that's great. And that's a good way to sort of explain it. It's a gap that needs to be filled in. And fortunately, you help fill us in that period of civil war. So, you know, Parliament had been unhappy with kings in the past, you know, famously King John. But in this case, with Charles I, it just went further. Can you talk to us a little bit about why Parliament was so upset with Charles I, maybe what he'd done, and what are some of the key points that brought us to the point where there's a gap in the monarchy?
Well, absolutely. And you're quite right. That relationship between the monarch and Parliament had always been a very living relationship. It had ebbed and flowed. It had had tensions and problems. It had had periods where it worked really well and periods where it worked very badly. Because there, obviously, there's an inherent tension there between the representatives of at least a small electorate at the time and the monarch. And, you know, being very simplistic about it, I guess a sort of Whig view of history is that as the centuries progressed, you know, the monarch became less powerful, Parliament became more powerful, and we eventually ended up with the parliamentary monarchy that we have today. But absolutely, the Parliament, Charles I had ruled without a Parliament for 11 years of what became known as the personal rule. When he was king, where he'd done without the Parliament, who he found a bit bothersome and annoying. And, you know, he tried to get round having a Parliament by doing things like raising his own taxes, coming up with new or in some cases old, ancient taxes that he brought back, things like ship money and forced loans from people and this kind of thing. And I think really it was an attempt to rule in a slightly more European manner, in a slightly more absolutist manner, which worried a lot of the MPs who had been MPs and sat in Parliament earlier in the 1620s and then been booted out and now had to sit twiddling their thumbs while this king and his court and his various ministers, you know, seemed to run things. And they were, you know, they weren't very happy with the things that he was getting up to. So there was a lot of grievances there. Also, in terms of religion, there was a sense that the Reformation, which had happened under the Tudors, you know, hadn't fully squared the circle. Queen Elizabeth I had had a sort of settlement of the church, really, that had kept a degree of peacefulness in her reign. But now here we are in the 1620s, then the 1630s, and there are some, there's a minority, as it were, of more puritanical people who feel that the church hasn't been reformed enough, and that actually they're worried that Charles I and his court seems to be increasingly taking the church back in a more Catholic direction. Which, you know, is a concern for them. So there's a lot of tensions bubbling along. And then, you know, we have a sort of the catalyst, really, for everything that kicks off in the 1640s is that there is a rebellion in Scotland against the king, who's trying to impose a new prayer book on the Scottish, who don't like this at all. The king is forced to recall Parliament, really, to fulfill the traditional role that parliaments have traditionally fulfilled, which is to raise money to fund the army to fight the Scots. But Parliament says, well, we'll give you your money, Your Majesty, but we also want you to address our grievances. Mm-hmm. And Charles I wasn't very keen on that. So he dissolved the Parliament. But again, he was running out of money. He's really struggling to govern these different kingdoms. And, you know, the English Civil War, as it used to be known, is very much now thought of as the British Civil Wars, or the War of the Three Kingdoms, because the tensions in what's going on in Ireland and Scotland are just as important, in fact, more important at this point. And then we end up with the Long Parliament, which is called the Parliament, which would go on to sit for about 20 years in quite extraordinary and dramatic circumstances. And, you know, there's a faction in this parliament led particularly by a man called John Pym, who are determined that now that they're back sitting in Westminster, they're not going to let the king get away with this kind of thing again. And, you know, they're going to force his hand in various ways. And a nasty rebellion in Ireland then also complicates the situation, and is used in a propagandist way, really, by Pym's faction in London. And, you know, Events spiral as they do. There's an argument about who should control the army, which is needed to deal with these rebellions in Ireland and Scotland. And Charles I tries to arrest some of the leading members of this faction, the arrest of the five members, where he walks into Parliament with the troops. And it's a very famous scene. They'd been tipped off, so they had left, and Charles is left empty-handed, looking rather silly, and has to say, although I see the birds have flown. So he's frustrated in that. And eventually he leaves London and raises his standard in Nottingham, and war has broken out now officially between the king and his parliament, which is an unprecedented event.
That is extraordinary, and I really appreciate you bringing in Scotland and Ireland, because that part of the story does sometimes get left out as well. I mean, this is a story of things being left out sometimes, but Charles is trying to really manage all kinds of things, and finally realizes he can't do it without Parliament, which gives Parliament some power. So you've mentioned Pym's, but someone else emerges during this period of time and it's interesting too to think that Charles is the one that leaves London while London is, you know, sort of held by Parliament at that point and the war breaks out. But bring Oliver Cromwell into this story. You mentioned him sometimes appearing on that Ruler of Rulers. but how does Cromwell gain the prominence and the position that he does in this kind of messy situation?
Well, absolutely. And you've put your finger on a really, really key point there. We tend often in the popular imagination, Cromwell is thought of as being a key figure throughout this period. In fact, a lot of people have a shorthand for these civil wars where they think of it as really the king and his royalists or his cavaliers against Cromwell, mm-hmm. leading the parliamentarians or the roundheads. But actually, Cromwell's a very minor figure, really, in the early years of this conflict. He is a minor gentleman from East Anglia, from the Fens. He's fallen on hard times before and sort of crawled his way back from really, really quite serious poverty. And he's now an MP in Parliament. And when Parliament goes to war against the king, Cromwell fights for Parliament. But again, in the first couple of years of the war, he's just a minor cavalry commander in his own region, in East Anglia and in the Eastern Association Army, which is the one that he belongs to. And so it's really not until the sort of middle years of the war that he starts to cut to more of a national figure. He achieves some fame because he is undoubtedly an enormous military talent, which in itself is quite remarkable because he is basically a gentleman farmer with no military experience in his 40s. Completely obscure man. He's never traveled beyond London, really. Never gone abroad, never seen any military action. So where this astonishing military talent comes from is very hard to tell. But yes, he gradually sort of works his way up the ranks in the army. And then the Battle of Marston Moor, which happens in July 1644, again, he plays a key role. And from that point on, he really is at the top table, in a sense, of the parliamentarian leadership. He gets a seat on the committee for both kingdoms, which runs Parliament's war effort. And he is a key figure then in this dramatic decision within the parliamentarian army, really, to kick out their aristocratic leaders and professionalize themselves into an amazing fighting force, which they call the New Model Army, which has one purpose, which is to completely and utterly defeat the king in the field. When there was a feeling amongst some of these men that the old leadership of Parliament's army, the Earl of Essex, the Earl of Manchester, hadn't really ever wanted to actually defeat the king in the field. And again, this is something that's really peculiar to a civil war here. If you're fighting against another nation, then obviously you want to defeat them. But if you're fighting within your own country against your own countrymen, in fact, you're fighting against your sovereign. And at this stage, again, it's important to remember that during the First Civil War in particular, almost everyone on both sides of the conflict still wants the king to be king at the end of the war. They just want him to be a king who doesn't overreach his prerogative powers. They want him to be a king who they can, restrain from being overmighty. So there's this sort of narrative which is familiar to us from many episodes in history, where the king isn't really blamed for these mistakes. It's the king's got bad advisors, he's got bad advice being given to him, and in fact there's a clause in the Earl of Essex's military contract that and he's the leader of Parliament's army initially, which is that he has to preserve the life of the king and has to look after the king. So they're fighting against the king, but are they really trying to win? And some of the other parliamentarian leaders, Sir Thomas Fairfax and Oliver Cromwell and others, are really a bit worried about this, because they feel that if if the king is allowed to win, to win and not have any restraints put upon him, then, they could all be hanged, frankly, as rebels. Quite feasible. So anyway, it's a very long answer, but basically, as we're getting to the very end of the First Civil War, Oliver Cromwell has emerged as a leading figure on Parliament's side, but by no means yet the sole leader and the dominant force.
It is interesting, as you mentioned, and I'm really glad you brought that up, that it's through his, however he came by it, his military success, he emerges not because he was born into it like some of the others, but by his merits in that way as the military leader. And that's how he gets a seat at the table. And that notion, that shift between we want to just worry the king versus we want to defeat the king, is a really interesting shift too. So I really like the way you're playing it out, because again, the shorthand of, well, there was Cromwell and then he wanted to do this. And, we just really lose that. So
we do. And it's a very easy shorthand for a very complicated conflict. Exactly.
Right. And sometimes even the language, and I love what you've said before on this, so I'm going to ask it again. Sometimes it's just sort of written off as the interregnum, which literally means between one king and the next king, there's this little blip. As if there's just this simple one line little blip that wasn't this complicated. So take us, instead of thinking of it as an interregnum, just a little blip, you're starting to get us really a sense of this complicated, multifaceted, multi-war. I mean, it's not just one quick English civil war. So tell us a little more about that.
Well, absolutely. I mean, just to skip through it quickly. As you say, there isn't just one war. There are, in fact, three wars. The king is defeated eventually by this new model army and imprisoned. But then again, he basically makes a deal with the Scots to come in and invade England again on his behalf. He plays the different sides off against each other. He's quite skillful at doing that. And so the nations are plunged into a second civil war in 1648, which is even more violent, even more brutal, even nastier than the first one. And again, there's a sense through this period that each of these wars is nastier and the stakes are higher and the geography has widened. So, you know, you almost have to see this as a kind of rolling stone, I guess, you know, rolling down a hill or something, gathering momentum. But yes, there's a second civil war. The king again is defeated. Again, at this point, you know, the parliamentarian coalition, and there's all sorts of interest groups here. There's levelers who are agitating for a whole new social contract and a whole new rights for people to come out of this. The army has become a kind of political force in its own right. And we have the army leadership who are trying to manage that. And then we have the people in parliament, the MPs, and they have different views about what should be done as well. But anyway, eventually there is a coup, in a sense, called Pride's Purge against Parliament, which the army removes those MPs who are not going to be happy about putting the king on trial. The king is then put on trial and found guilty and executed. And this is in January 1649. So what we then have is this, as you say, extraordinary 11-year period of a republic where there is no king. No king or queen, no monarch. You know, as many of your listeners will know, eventually King Charles I's son, Charles II, is restored in 1660. So we have this strange period where we have one King Charles at the beginning, one King Charles at the end, and then this 11-year gap. And really, I guess the best way to think about those 11 years is as a series of constitutional experiments. Really, it's a classic example, and we see it often in history, don't we, where a coalition joins together to achieve a certain aim, often through war or revolution. And then once they've defeated their common enemy, they don't know what to do next. So they all argue, they all fall out amongst each other in the 1650s as to what on earth do you replace the monarchy with? You know, England has had a monarchy, Scotland too, for all these centuries. And it's completely interwoven into the laws and into the customs, and into every aspect of life. And how do you start again? So there's a few years of a Commonwealth, which is really where the Parliament, the rump of Parliament that has remained, the House of Commons only, because the House of Lords was abolished when the king was executed. So there's a solitary chamber, a House of Commons, and a whole lot of committees, a kind of council of state, and endless busy, busy, busy committees. And they run things for the first few years of the Commonwealth. But again, they're not doing terribly well. They send Cromwell and troops off to Ireland and to Scotland to deal with uprisings there. And that's where Cromwell perpetrates his infamous deeds and violence against the Irish in particular. And then when he comes back, this rump of Parliament, you know, really hasn't achieved the things that the parliamentarian army leadership were desiring that they would. They hadn't achieved legal reform. They hadn't achieved electoral reform. They hadn't really brought in religious toleration, which is what a lot of people don't realise, but what a lot of the leaders like Cromwell in the army wanted. They wanted a tolerant, religious settlement. So anyway, the rump is expelled by the army. We then have a brief nominated assembly of saintly sort of godly men who are summoned from all corners of the kingdom and predictably are fairly hopeless at actually governing. And then that assembly dissolves itself, and the army goes to Cromwell and says, okay, you know, we're in a real fix now. We think you should be head of state as Lord Protector. Over a government. So he says yes. And then we have from 1653, this is, and then we have five, six years of really Cromwell as a head of state. He's not a king, but he is sovereign. He's a head of state, and he exercises power. Sovereignty is enacted by him working with Parliament. So in a funny way, we're back to a slightly kingly monarchic structure, albeit with a lot of the symbolism and language of royalty taken out of it and some of the republican ideas of the Commonwealth preserved.
Okay, so you bring up the idea of some of the monarchy pieces being gone. And one of the things that we all just saw with the coronation of King Charles III was the regalia. And so that is one of the things that happens. And can you tell us about that, where the jewels were sold off and the gold was often melted down and turned into coins that were used as a part of the new government? So can you tell us a little bit about that? Because here we have a head, but he's not the king. He's not wearing a crown. Mm-hmm. So what happened to all that bling?
Absolutely. And it's such a great story, isn't it? Particularly, as you say, now we've just had another coronation of another King Charles, yes. Which was amazing to see that. But yes, you know, Parliament is really short of money after they have killed the king and won all these wars. Wars are horrible drains on finance. And, you know, in fairness, the Commonwealth government and Cromwell in particular, it's one of the charges, you know, often thrown at them that they were uncivilized kind of hooligans, because they took all these lovely jewels and crowns and everything and sold them off or melted them down. But you know, that is true. But I always like to say, in their defense, that actually they're trying to raise some money to pay mm-hmm. the soldiers and to repair the nation. So you know, it's always worth remembering that. But the interesting thing is that when Cromwell first becomes Lord Protector, it is quite pared back. You know, he has quite a sort of simple solemn ceremony where he's sworn in, but he does move into the royal palaces of Hampton Court and Whitehall, and you know, he does actually start to rule with a court around him, and his family live there with him. And you know, gradually as the years go on, this protectorate regime starts to look more and more like a monarchy. And, you know, they live in quite splendid style. I mean, you know, much more cheaply and modestly than the Stuart kings or Tudor kings before them. But it is, to all intents and purposes, a court. And there are foreign ambassadors from from other powers who come and, you know, live there and pay homage. And there's diplomacy going on. There's foreign policy. It's all very interesting. And there's also feasts and masks and hunting and hawking and all the things we tend to associate with early modern courts. But then actually Parliament decides that it wants to maybe make Cromwell king. And there's lots of reasons for this. But it's thought maybe that will put the protectorate regime on a more secure footing, more traditional footing. And Cromwell actually says no. He agonizes over it for months. But he finally, although he actually probably thought that a constitutional monarchy probably was the best form of government and most stable form of government, he felt personally that he would appear to be a hypocrite if he became king. And he also thought that God didn't want him to do it. And he didn't want to anger the rest of the army who were a bit who didn't like this idea. But anyway, he says no to the crown, but he does accept a new constitution. And he is reinvested as Lord Protector for a second time in June 1657. And that's where this coronation and these crown jewels come back, because Cromwell's investiture in June 1657 really is, in to all intents and purposes, a coronation. There's he's wearing ermine robes. He processes into Westminster Hall. It takes place in Westminster Hall. And he sits kind of under a canopy. He's presented with all of the surviving regalia other than the crown, because he hasn't accepted the crown. But he's given this, you know, sword of state and a big gilt Bible. He has to swear an oath. Then everyone cheers and there's a trumpet fanfare and they cry out, you know, God save Lord Protector or whatever. And then he comes out and they have a big procession through London with lots of horse-drawn carriages, and there's wine flowing in the fountains and everything. I mean, it really, really does look like a coronation, and like the fact that Cromwell is king in all but name. But as so often with the monarchy in Britain, or at least, you know, monarchical tradition, there's a lot of adaptability going on here. There's a lot of nuance. And although this ceremony borrowed a lot of these ideas from coronations, you know, the oath and the sword and the Bible and the ermine robe and, you know, all this stuff, the big party afterwards, that's all the same. But there's some interesting differences. So it's in Westminster Hall, not Westminster Abbey, because it's a secular event. It's not a church event. And that's all about the fact the church had been disestablished. Has been separated from the state. Similarly, it's the Speaker of the House of Commons who presides and who puts the crown on Cromwell's head, not the crown, but puts the robe on him and the sword and all of that, not the Archbishop of Canterbury. And there's no sort of mystical moment of holy oil, you know, anointment. So it's almost like it's a sort of secular coronation with the sort of mystery and the religion stripped out of it. But it's a uniquely fascinating moment, I think, in our monarchical history, really. This little moment where, you know, Britain tried on a quasi-republican, quasi-royal sort of way of going about things to see if it would work.
Well, yes. And as you say, that gap that's often thought of as just an unchanging gap. It's just either called a commonwealth or called an interregnum, and it's all the same. You've described how it changed from the first defeat of the king to ongoing defeats to eventually the trial and execution. And even after that, it evolved as time went on. Different things were tried. So trying on different ways of running the country without a monarchy. So, why do you think, with all of that, with all the different things, and eventually this king in all but name, and this seems to settle for a bit, why doesn't it succeed? What goes wrong? Because we know eventually that ruler of rulers comes back to life. So how do we get back to Charles II?
Yeah, absolutely. It is. It's a real counterfactual. It's a real knotty, fun what if in history, this. Because actually at the point where Cromwell's reinvested as Lord Protector, the regime is doing reasonably well, actually. Mm-hmm. It's not massively popular, I must say. There's a lot of people who don't like it, you know, on the ground. But, you know, it's starting to look a bit less frightening, a bit less military. The rule of the major generals, where different regions of England had been governed directly by army leaders, which had been very unpopular and a bad plan all round. You know, that's been phased out. It's looking a bit more traditional, a little bit more conservative, in a good way. Small c, which, you know, people like. And, you know, Cromwell really is the man who can hold it all together. But then Cromwell died. Cromwell died, you know, really very unexpectedly, in a sense, in September 1658, probably from malaria, which he'd always had actually from his Fenland upbringing, and which was quite common in England in the 17th century, and precipitated by the death of his daughter, Elizabeth, who he was devoted to. And she died probably of cancer in the summer. And it utterly, according to all contemporaries, it utterly broke him, broke his heart, destroyed him, and he just didn't recover from it. He died a month after she did. And then his son, Richard, his eldest surviving son, but again, in another weird what-if counterfactual, Richard was actually Cromwell's third son. Poor old Cromwell and his wife had already lost their two older sons, in one as a teenager and one in his 20s. So really, really horrible, devastating losses for the family. But Richard takes over. And, you know, he's known to history as Tumble Down Dick, because perhaps he wasn't best suited to this position. But again, you know, history is always changing, isn't it? And a lot of revisionist historians are looking at Richard again and saying, well, you know, he did reasonably well and in a, with what he could do. And in a sense, you know, there were some benefits to the fact that he wasn't his father. There were people who, you know, people who would never reconcile with Oliver Cromwell. He was too Marmite a figure. But perhaps, you know, perhaps they could work with Richard, who hadn't really fallen out with anyone. But anyway, you know, he really struggles to reconcile the armies the army's power. And this is at the heart of, you know, your question about why the protectorate falls, why the Commonwealth ends, why the king comes back. Several reasons. You know, firstly, I think there is a sense that the love of monarchy runs very deep for the English. And all these constitutional experiments, none of them quite work. None of them quite are the same or achieve the same magic that somehow a sort of, a monarchy, a king in parliament manages to do. I think secondly, there's a problem with this huge standing army, which is still in existence after the Civil War. How to integrate that army into a peacetime state, into the state, it is a really thorny problem because, you know, underpinning the protectorate all the time is the army. There is this sort of whiff of rule by the sword, which people aren't very comfortable with, understandably. And the army leadership in particular have a really tricky relationship with Parliament and resent the fact that Parliament and, you know, a lot of the leading figures in Parliament are becoming more powerful. They're gaining quite a lot of influence over Richard, just as they had over Oliver towards the end of his life. And the army leaders feel annoyed about this. They feel they're the ones who, you know, fought, were wounded, died in many cases, you know, gave their blood and their lives for this cause, this good old cause. And now they're being shouldered out by often, you know, these new men, these new younger sort of soft civilian MPs who were now trying to turn the clock back in a sense and to make everything a bit more palatable, a bit more traditional. And then the third problem really is the perennial problem of religion. It's how to find a religious settlement that is going to keep everybody happy. And, you know, Cromwell always wanted a more tolerant settlement and a more liberty of conscience, as it is called at the time, than Parliament did, actually, ironically. So he always struggled with his parliaments over that issue. And so, you know, we've got to the point in 1659 where we have a young, inexperienced head of state, Richard Cromwell, who's not particularly great. He's fine, but the army end up really mounting a coup against him. They fear he's going to work with Parliament to muscle them out. And they achieve what I like to call the biggest own goal in British history, because they pull down Richard Cromwell and the Protectorate and usher in a period, a year or so, of utter chaos and madness, which, in fairness to old Oliver, Oliver had kept those forces at bay the whole time that he had been Lord Protector. Yes, it wasn't a perfect regime, but there wasn't anarchy. There wasn't civil war. There wasn't, you know, things were stable. But at this point, you know, we have a very complicated year or so with different factions. We have the Parliament recalled and, you know, various another military coup. Their General Monk, who's an army general up in Scotland, decides to march down from Scotland and almost force the issue and recall the Parliament, you know, before it had been expelled, before it had been purged, the Rump Parliament, bring back the Rump Parliament, knowing that they would probably vote to ask Charles II in exile to come back. And that's exactly what happens. But, you know, so in a sense, this is the complicating factor of this whole period. The parliamentarians, the roundheads, they won the civil war, but ultimately they lost because the monarchy came back. But, you know, I would always say, May have lost in the sense the monarch comes back, but it is not the same monarchy. You know, it really isn't the same. The legacy of this extraordinary period is that the monarchy under Charles II and thereafter, especially once we've had the Glorious Revolution in 1688, is more controlled. It's more constitutional. It's more limited. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the English, the British have learned a great number of valuable lessons from this chaotic period.
Right. And the monarch too. I mean, I know Charles came back, Charles II comes back, and he does want some sense of punishment for those particularly involved in his father's demise. But he also agrees to the conditions through which he's invited back. So he, you know, walks a line, but is restored, but in a very different way, as you said. So it is a different monarchy. And probably that opens the door for eventually the Glorious Revolution, the idea that the negotiation.
Well, it does, absolutely. And you're quite right. Charles II, you know, is a more skillful politician and monarch than his father. Mm-hmm. And he does know when to negotiate and when to accept things. So he is brought back on those more that more limited basis. And there is a sense that, you know, monarchs really are going to be held to account from now on, which is, you know, at bottom line, what, as you say, ends up happening when Charles II's brother, James II, succeeds, mm-hmm. and eventually the Glorious Revolution, where William and Mary come in, and we have a famous Bill of Rights, and, you know, the James II is exiled. And, you know, that is seen, again, it's maybe a simplification, but in a sense, that Glorious Revolution is completing some unfinished business from the Civil Wars. Mm-hmm. That sense that, you know, from then on, really, Parliament does have the whip hand. Monarch is still enormously important, but especially, you know, once we have the Glorious Revolution, and then, you know, the Act of Settlement, which brings in the Hanoverians, mm-hmm. in the 18th century, early 18th century as well, you know, by that stage, there really is a sense that the monarch, although it's a hereditary monarchy in Britain, you know, it's more a parliamentary monarchy in a sense. Parliament chooses who's mm-hmm. going to be the next successor. And, you know, with James II, they choose, you know, he's a Catholic. Right. We don't want his heir, his little baby who may have been smuggled in a warming pan, as they like to say, you know, we're going to choose to bypass him and go to his Protestant daughters. And again, with the Hanoverian succession, you know, right. there's huge numbers of people ahead of George I in the line of succession. But they're all, you know, they're all skipped over in favor of a Protestant. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the monarchy is irrevocably changed, in my view, by the Civil War.
Absolutely. And Parliament is also changed in terms mm-hmm. of their power over or with the shared power with the monarch or something like that. And it, you're exactly right. The Hanoverian choice, clearly Parliament's choosing who's next there over a lot of closer relatives. So thank you for that. Now, I do want to mention I was in the UK. Oh, this way. I was in the UK, so I was able to get this marvelous Great. Book, not available in the US yet. I practically burst into song in the bookstore. But right here, can you see yes. the Commonwealth and the Protectorate?
Isn't that
and
great?
There you are. So, yes, here we go. So, can That's you just me. Tell us? This is wonderful because it's called Kings and Queens, but it does get a section. So, tell us about how you were chosen to do this and what that experience was like. Because I just think that's so great that there's this place in the book for it.
I'm so thrilled. And thank you for picking up a copy, Carol Anne. It's a great read, I must say, actually. Not just my chapter on Oliver Cromwell, obviously. But no, I was thrilled. I was approached by Ian Dale, who's the overall editor of the book. And again, actually, it's an anecdote. It's a tale of the power of podcasting, because I had appeared on another podcast called History Hack with Alexandra Churchill and Charlotte White and various others. I'd appeared on with them a couple of times, actually. And it was Alex Churchill who recommended me to Ian Dale when he was looking for someone to write about Oliver Cromwell.
Oh,
so
wonderful.
The power of the podcast network, there you are, in essence. But yes, he approached me to write it. And I was so thrilled that Oliver and Richard Cromwell are included, as you say, because, and I try and make this point in my essay, that, you know, you can obviously split hairs and semantics about, you know, who is a king, who is a queen, what is a monarch. But if the point of Ian's book is to tell the story of how the British monarchy evolved over, you know, the last 1,000 years and more than that. And really, you can't understand that properly without covering that 11-year period, really. I mean, there is an argument to say that Cromwell, and he was operating as a, maybe not a king, but he was a monarch. He was a sovereign. He was head of state. He was called Your Highness. Mm-hmm. He had that power. You know, he really is the sovereign. So he definitely deserves his spot in the book. But there's an argument that some historians make that actually there should be a statue of the statue of Cromwell, which is famously outside Parliament in London, in Parliament Square, should actually be outside Buckingham Palace, because actually Cromwell, in his time as Lord Protector, through his actions, almost helps to keep monarchy going and helps the monarchy triumph and come back, ironically, in some ways. But yes, I was thrilled to be part of that story, and for Ian to take such an inclusive approach to who should be in the book. And it's not just actually Oliver and Richard Cromwell who make it in, but all sorts of other also rans and brief claimants to the throne. You know, we have Lady Jane Grey in there, we have Stephen and Matilda, we have all of these people. We even have King Louis of France. Said he was king. So it's a lovely broad church. It's a lovely thorough coverage of anyone who was vaguely in Britain. So I definitely recommend it to your listeners.
Well, yes, and I'll have a link for it. It's not available in the US yet, but you can just, you know, hop on a plane. That's what I did, and it was wonderful. Well, I think it's so important, and I was so excited to see it in there and to see you in there. But I do think it's really important to consider the full story as you look at the arc of monarchy. And so I do really appreciate your being here. Now, can you tell us anything you're working on now, or how the listeners can be in touch and follow you?
Oh, I can, of course. I'd be delighted to. Actually, what I'm working on now, so I previously had written a couple of historical novels about Oliver Cromwell's daughters. In fact, anyone watching this can see them unashamedly displayed behind me.
Good.
The Puritan Princess and the Rebel Daughter. But actually what I'm writing now is a popular history book, nonfiction history book, and it's about the Cromwell family. It's going to be called The House of Cromwell. And I've just started it. It's going to be coming out in 2 or 3 years' time. But actually the idea behind it is to take Oliver Cromwell, who we've been talking about today, and this Civil War period, but link Oliver and Richard Cromwell, his son, back 100 years to Thomas Cromwell of Henry VIII and Wolf Hall fame, who was actually Oliver's great-great-great uncle. So they do belong to the same family. And the idea behind the book really is to tell an alternative, subversive history to run alongside the history of the Tudors and the Stuarts, arguing that we should see the whole period as the story of the Tudors, the Stuarts, and the Cromwells. That's the idea.
Oh, that's wonderful. And yes, Thomas Cromwell certainly made his mark. So to think of that as the House of Cromwell, I cannot wait. That's really exciting.
Great. Thank you.
And I was going to mention the nonfiction. So you have the two nonfiction. Are you doing any more nonfiction as well?
Well, I might do down the line. I've got lots of ideas for novels I'd love to write. So and my editor has sort of indicated that she'd be happy for me to do a bit more fiction in the future as well. So hopefully both. I mean, my passion is this period, really. And what I love to do is find the best way to write, the best way to tell these particular stories. And sometimes that's fiction. So for the women in Cromwell's family, actually a fictional approach worked better for them, because as so often and frustratingly with women in the past, they're marginalized and you have to try and kind of piece their story together and use more imagination. But then for this big sort of dynastic book about the Cromwell family and the towering figures of Thomas and Oliver, wanted to write history and nonfiction about that. So it's about how we get other people to be as passionate about, you know, the periods that we love as we are, isn't it?
That's wonderful. And I really appreciate your saying it's the best way to tell their story, because some people, it's just a different way of telling a story. And we want to find, like you say, those women's voices aren't always as easy to find. So, well, thank you. This has been such a treat to learn more about the period and through your explanation, really understand how fascinating, complicated, multi-layered it was. This little tiny gap on the ruler of rulers turns out to be this whole story, multiple stories, multiple kingdoms and multiple attempts. And I am so appreciative to your taking us through that. So again, thank you so much for being with us. Really appreciate it, Miranda.
Thank you for having me. I've really enjoyed talking to you, Carol Anne. It's been a great pleasure.
Well, thank you. And thank you everyone for listening. I'll have some links to this book, to Miranda and other things she's doing. And so we can keep following her as well. So thank you everyone for joining us, and come back again as we keep shaking up history together. Thank you.